Good evening, James McKinney here with my San Sour, January 7th, 2016. The first show of 2016, amazing. I'm sure glad that 2015 is over. Ugh, that was just kind of like write that year off. But 2016 promises to be a very exciting year. First of all, thank you everybody for that super response to the new release. This was something, well, that was another surprise piled on another surprise. The release itself was a surprise. But the fabulous response and the commentaries coming back from people going, you know, you did it. This is brilliant. This is all these various comments. People just saying, you know, you hit it the nail on the head. What you did is correct. And, well, of course, I know that. One thing that I learned when I was in college, I may have learned it earlier, but I perfected it in college, and that is that you have to be self-correcting. You have to be hard on yourself. You have to be in a position where you understand, you can project what the answer is, and then put all the convincing evidence together, and then be able to present it to other people so that they can follow all of the trains of thought and come to the same conclusion and go, you are correct. This is correct. And the Nazca lines, the fact that it is an ancient interferometer fractal antenna complex is absolutely correct. And in the meantime, I've noticed a bunch of nuances that didn't come out right away. Very intricate aspects to this design. Very amazing. So at any rate, but once again, thank you for the great response. The new release price did go up to $20, as promised, and people are buying it. People that missed the special, but anyway, you know, a lot of people bought it. I'm probably one of the few people on the planet that can pre-sell a book when people don't even know what the title is. And this has been going on back from the early days when I'm, you know, my Atlantis to Tesla book. It started with that book. When I released it on Coast to Coast, I put up basically a flyer. There was a new book coming out. And the first three printings had sold out before anybody even knew the title. When the title was announced, it was like the, roulette wheel or the one-armed bandit machine in Las Vegas. The sales just went zzzz all night. It was amazing. It actually doubled what my credit card, my merchant account would accept. And that night I sold out of many printings of the book. And of course I only had one printing printed. So we had to get the presses rolling overnight to print the books. It was just an amazing, amazing success. It went into orbit. But I love that. And this, it isn't today like it is was in the good old days. But still, this response to this new release was very super. You can still get it if you buy over $250 worth of product on the sales page. You can get it for free. But, of course, the pricing of the products have gone up again. The sale ended last week on all the water filter products. But they're still there. People are still buying them, even though the price has gone up, because they're the best water filter products on the planet or in this corner of the galaxy, I would wager. So at any rate, the continuation of interest in the Nazca Palpa Lines special release, it's just every day I get commentary, the orders are coming in, etc. I'll do a little bit more commentary on that tonight, but I have made another discovery. Interestingly enough, I'll just give you a hint. It has to do with the rocks that are found at the site. And I'm not going to say any more than that, other than there's something very interesting regarding the rocks at the site, at the Nazca site. And I mean, it just gets, as I plow through this analysis, it gets even more interesting. Since it is the first show of the new year, I wanted to give a brief analysis on what is happening with NASA and planetary exploration and manned space travel. Nothing. They are continuing with the space station. We really don't hear much about that at all. They have a couple residual planetary probes that are occurring, the MAVEN mission on Mars, for example, etc. But the main science portion of those has been completed. And really, in 2016, nothing is happening in terms of manned spaceflight or in terms of new interplanetary data gathering or whatever. Like I say, a few residuals. There's a residual from the European Space Agency, but really nothing going on. So you won't have to hear me say anything more about NASA the whole rest of the year. Just a quick commentary. I was on a radio show yesterday with Dr. Bill Deagle, and we were going to talk about some other topics. And at the beginning of this issue up in Oregon came up, and we just talked about it the whole hour, and it's very interesting. I mean, batting the ideas back and forth, but it is a very strange situation. That's the best thing I can say about it. It doesn't make any sense at all. The best thing I can make out of it is that this was a planned government court case, because the end result was these two guys, the guy and his son, Hammond and his kid, end up spending a number of years in prison over starting a fire on 127 acres of land. Okay, well, there's some extenuating circumstances. But the issue is they come out of prison, the judge, the federal judge, goes, hey, you didn't serve enough time. I'm going to throw you back in a slammer for another 4 years each. And they go, okay, not a problem. And I'm like, wait a minute. You can't convict or double sentence somebody. This is, you know, this is under federal guidelines. You cannot double convict somebody for a crime. You can't do it. So this guy's attorney must be the most brain dead yo-yo on the planet, or in collusion with the federal government. But anyway, I'm just not going to go into it anymore. But other than that, the Bundys show up from Nevada, occupy the reserve not the Federal Reserve building, but there's a refuge there, a national refuge, the building, the federal building that goes along with it, the Bundys occupy this and are calling for states' rights and throwing the federal government off the land. The federal government does not respond in any shape or form. The local sheriff is just telling everybody, please stand back so that there's no trouble here. It's really a bizarre situation. It's going to get more interesting before it gets less interesting, let's put it that way. But no more comment on that other than it's in an area where Oregon is a state that is organizing to leave the union. So And understand that probably the correct way to do all of this would be for the local people in the state, not necessarily the people that were convicted of setting a fire, but the local people should take up the state's right issue in the state court and throw the federal government out. But anyway, I'm not going to talk any more about that, other than the strangeness factor going on in this case in Oregon is just off the charts. Something fishy is going on there, and I don't trust the Hammond guy at all. I mean, he just sounds like he's playing along with the federal government, like they convict him to another 4 years in prison for lighting a fire on 127 acres of land that he was about to lease for ranching. No, something very bizarre and strange is going on there. Other than that, I won't say anymore. Tonight, I'll be talking a bit more about the Nazca Palpa release of last week. And if you didn't catch that, you got to listen to last week's show, December 31st, 2015. My radio show, I made a release. It was pre-announced. It sold very well in the pre-release. But anyway, here's what it amounts to. The famous Nazca figures and lines that are out in this high desert region of west central Peru. I was there and as a tourist and just kind of looking over things, and I was out on some of the mounts and looking at this, and I go, man, these are atmospheric collection sites for atmospheric electricity. And so I'm going, what the heck? And so I put it all together, and that on the location I put it all together that these were fractal interferometer telescopes and radio antennas for communicating, obviously, with other star systems. So anyway, that's what the white paper is all about. In my show last week, I did the release on last week's show, so you got to listen to that. Get the white paper, 72 pages or 74 pages. It's on my webpage, jmccsci.com. But tonight I want to talk about space travel. Now, the concept of space travel has been so distorted because of NASA and their tiddlywinks space programs that the public really doesn't have a grasp on what it takes to get other places like to Mars or to Pluto, for example. They just took, you know, a better part of a decade to get to the planet Pluto. And this is what they do. They do a burst thrust with a rocket engine, and then they glide. They basically coast. They also use planetary gravitational assist, which is the opposite of capture. In other words, they send the spacecraft around a planet, and they get what is loosely termed a slingshot effect. And it goes out and it gains velocity and then can reach the planetary target, like Pluto or Saturn or other planets, etc. It can reach them sooner. But let's take an example. I talked about this last week a little bit, dealing with space travel. We live on a planet called Earth. The gravity that pulls you down to Earth is called 1G gravity. One unit of gravity is the Earth gravity. And the little G is the symbol we use in physics. You learn that in physics 101, what gravity is, Newton's law of gravity, of reaction, you know, etc., Newton's three laws, etc. So anyway, but 1G, say you're in an airplane, you're in a high-performance airplane, they talk about 2Gs or 3Gs, and that's the force on the pilot as he goes through a maneuver, and that's the force on the pilot strapped into that seat. He experiences more than 1G force. But imagine we built a spacecraft, and we sent it out into outer space, and it had the ability to accelerate at 1G. This is with a rocket engine, so the feeling you get by being in that rocket is one of the same force as being on Earth. Now, that's being artificially projected by the force of the rocket. The rocket is making the rocket engine is making the rocket accelerate by burning fuel and blasting it out the back end, and you go at a 1G acceleration. Now, what if you did this? I talk about this also in the white paper about interstellar travel. What if you could do this continuously? And everybody might say, well, you can't do that because you'd have to carry all this fuel along. Well, you can do this. And I designed propulsion systems that can do this without ejecting material out the back end of a rocket. They're called non-inertial propulsion systems. Electromagnetic propulsion systems, and there's two designs. One of them you can find in my book, Atlantis to Tesla, The Colburn Connection. It's a design that was published in IEEE. I presented it at the IEEE's the engineering journal. I presented it at the International Electric Propulsion Conference dealing with the military. I also presented it at the Aerospace America Air Show in San Diego about 1985, I believe that was. It's where I met Bert Rutan. And he was there presenting some of his composite materials. And it was basically a show and tell in the United States, something like akin to the Paris Air Show. But, okay, so anyway, let's go back to the concept of moving out into outer space towards Mars, towards Jupiter, towards Pluto, or beyond to the next star using a 1G acceleration. How long would it take you to get to the next star system? And, of course, you can't keep accelerating. At a certain point, you're going to start getting up close to the speed of light. So I'll be talking about that. How long does that take? Once you get up close to the speed of light, my recommendation is that you maintain an interstellar velocity of 3/4 the speed of light. Why is that? Because you don't deal with any of the relativistic effects. And so you're still dealing in the realm of Newtonian physics. Now, that could change in the future as we start to understand better what it's like to travel at those speeds. But for right now, for beginners, you can still do interstellar travel by getting up to 3/4 the speed of light. All of the relativistic effects are absolutely minimal, and you're still dealing with Newtonian physics. All of the other aspects of normal life would be the same. So here's the scenario. You accelerate at 1G up until you get to 3/4 the speed of light. Then you go into cruise mode. Now, this is interstellar because you wouldn't get up to that speed just going out to Pluto at the edge of our solar system. So you go into the next star, or say a star like Sirius, which is 8.6 light years away. You get up to 3/4 the speed of light. You go into cruise mode. You're going at 3/4 the speed of light. And then when you get to a certain point away from Sirius, you start to brake at the speed, at the 1G acceleration. So you turn your rocket engine around. You turn your rocket engine around. You brake until you, at 1G acceleration or deceleration, I should say, until you get to, say, the other star system, and then you're traveling at near zero velocity when you come in to make your landing. Okay, so anyway, how long does it take to get up to 3/4 of the speed of light with a 1G acceleration? This you can do, my friends. This is a very basic physics problem. It takes about 3/4 of a year. Now let's say we're going to the next star system over, which is a little over four light years, the Centauri system. And let's say we're going to go take a visit there. You go to 3/4 of the speed of light. Now you're going to travel. That's going to take you a part of the way out to the next star system. You travel for a number of years at 3/4 the speed of light, and then you break, and then you come into the other end. You can figure out that this is going to take you about, the total trip is going to be about 6.5 years. So let me go through this whole scenario so it's clear. The 1G acceleration, it takes you 2/3 of a year to get up to that 3/4 of the speed of light. How far do you go in that 2/3 of a year, about 8 months? You're going to go about 0.12 light years, about 1/10 of a light year. So you didn't get that far in the first 2/3 of a year. But then you're cruising, you go into cruise mode, you're cruising at 3/4 the speed of light, and let's say you're going to the next star system 4.3 light years away. You cruise for 5 years at 3/4 of the speed of light. Okay, now you turn the thruster around, you brake, you decelerate at 1G, so you get that feeling of 1G of gravity once again, and you decelerate into the next star system, the Centauri star system, and By the time you get there, you're going 0 miles an hour. You're braking the entire time. And so how long has this whole trip taken you to go you're going 4.3 light years? By this method, it's going to take you about 6.5 years. That's less time than it took NASA to go to Pluto with the New Horizons spacecraft. Why is that? Because they went up to a very relatively low velocity and cruised out to the planet Pluto. Now, if you use the same technique of accelerating at 1G to go to Pluto, the trip out to Pluto would be very much reduced. It would hardly take you any time at all. A trip to Mars would be a couple weeks because most of that time would be accelerating, decelerating. So going to the other planets, going to other star systems is not that big a deal if you are not using inertial propulsion systems. Rockets will not get us to the next star system. Rockets are not the way to go into outer space. It's stupid. Rockets are stupid technology. The Chinese were using rockets equivalent, just a little crude, but maybe not that much more crude than they strap on the side of the space shuttle. Those solid booster rockets are nothing more than a medieval Chinese rocket. That's from probably 2000 BC the Chinese were using rockets. And so there's a story, by the way. This guy, this Chinese emperor, wanted to go into outer space. He had this concept. So he had his workmen strap all these rockets onto his throne. They lit it. He took off. Never was seen again. He may still be in orbit. Who knows? Anyway, not a good idea. Don't try that at home. So anyway, this is the way to get to another star system. Modern rocket technology will not get us there. Because why? Because you have to carry this massive amount of fuel along to heat up and shoot out the end of the rocket. Inertial rockets will not get you there. That's why I invented the non-inertial electromagnetic propulsion system. And that's the way to get to other star systems. You get an acceleration up to about 1G. It's very doable. A trip to, for example, Sirius, 8.6 light years away, is about an 11-year trip. Not very long. In fact, less time than some of the planetary endeavors by NASA. So, at any rate, why is this important? Because interstellar travel is not that big a deal when you understand that you can't use inertial rockets. Let's go back to the Nazca planes in Peru. The Nazca planes in Peru were designed, they're meant to be, they were designed to be communication between other star systems. Now you think, well, if you're going to have a conversation, you know, you'd have to signal, say we were signaling to Alpha Centauri, 4.3 light years away. Well, on your Nazca planes transmitter, you would transmit. It would take 4.3 light years to get there. It would take them a little bit of time, a day or something, to decipher the message and pack another message and send it back to us. And that would be about 8.6 years just to have a little teeny conversation. But that's not what you would do. You would be sending your news, just like having a newspaper, you would be sending your message continually, and it would be in a non-response mode. In other words, the conversation is going on in both directions all the time. So you're telling about what's happening here on Earth, sending your transmission, the Morse type code or the zeros and one type code or whatever the encoding was that they were using. You're sending out your messages continuously, telling what's going on, how many kids were born, you know, what the if there was a big comet in the area, you know, was there something of note going on in our solar system? You'd be sending this information out continually, and the people on Alpha Centauri, the Alpha Centaurians, would be sending us their stream of information. The same with Sirius, the same with the Pleiades, the same with the belt of Orion stars, and on and on and on. So we would be in constant communication with these other star systems not as a conversation. And of course, at some point, they might get an information, hey, there's a big comet in our solar system. It's wreaking havoc with everything. We're going to be hit by this thing. Come and save us, you know, or something like that. And if the Alpha Centaurians could get there within the time to save the planet and help somebody, maybe they could. But I get the impression that even the big comets, etc., are something that even the most advanced alien cultures don't mess with, because they're meant to be. They're part of nature's plan, and you don't mess with nature's plan any more than if we could put out all the forest fires, we'd probably say, hey, we shouldn't put out all the forest fires. In fact, the Forestry Service actually starts fires when there are not enough fires to advance the growth of the forest, so to speak. So once we get into outer space, we have to make a lot of decisions. Are we going to interfere with nature's method of say, advancing civilizations or evolution or whatever it may be? Are we going to interfere with this, or are we going to just let nature take its course? But the idea is that communication with the transmitters and receivers, for example, in the Nazca plane, would be continual between Earth and these other star systems. But additionally, were these people strapped to Earth? Were they here without the ability to go to another star system? That we don't know. We don't know. We don't know who built the Nazca lines and figurines. We don't know when they were built, but I'll just give you a little hint. Part of the discovery that I made this past week, in addition to the understanding that these are interferometer fractal antennas in the Nazca complex and Palpa complex, besides understanding that, I now understand that there's a way of determining some factors about when these were done by examining the rocks. And I'm not talking about a dating process. There's some other very interesting features of the rocks that are telltale and could specifically tell us the time frame approximately when these figures were made. And so I'm working on that in the background. As this unfolds, it's just amazing to me, all of the various aspects of this study. It's just, for me, it's phenomenal. I actually have to put the brakes on in this and get back to some of my other work that's got put on the shelf because of this. And so, but anyway, this was such an important release that I couldn't help but taking the time out, the number of weeks that it took to put it all together, release it, do all the background work, and all of the other things necessary for a release like this. But it's so important to understand interstellar space travel. That's what I wanted to concentrate on tonight. So let me go through this scenario again, and anybody who's kind of like understands basic physics or wants to reproduce the numbers that I just gave on this program, this is very rudimentary physics 101. And remember, we never get up to the speed of light, so none of the relativistic effects take place. You could do it so you get up to the speed of light, and that would change things a little bit. Also, you might arrive at the other star system a bit younger. So those are all interesting effects. But once again, you go with an acceleration of 1G, equivalent of one Earth gravity. This is in your rocket system where you're going off to another star system. You go at 1G acceleration until you hit 3/4 of the speed of light. When you hit 3/4 of the speed of light, you stop your acceleration, you go into cruise mode, and you cruise until you get to the exact distance that it took you to get up to that 3/4 of the speed of light. When you get to that distance away from the upcoming star, the star that you're going to, you turn your rocket thruster around, and I'm saying that figuratively. You turn your thrusting device around, because you're not using a rocket engine per se. not an inertial rocket engine. You are using an electromagnetic propulsion system, but you turn up the throttle, so to speak, so you are braking, decelerating at 1G, and you cruise into the star system at near zero velocity, so then you can maneuver in and get next to the planet where you want to land and say hello to all your buddies, have a barbecue, have a beer, whatever they do on Alpha Centauri or Sirius or wherever you're going to. And the time frame to do this, to go 4.3 light years to the nearest star, Alpha Centauri, would take about 6.5 years. To go to Sirius, which is 8.6 light years away, would take around 12 light years. So that's not too excessive an amount of time, considering you're getting to another star system. So interstellar travel is very doable. This is my message. Expecting aliens to come here from another star system, not that big a deal. That that all of the hullabaloo put on this by professional astronomers is really over the top, because they're dealing with inertial rocket engines. They're dealing with old technology that you would never use in a million years to go to another star system. And it just doesn't work. So at any rate, it's very important to understand that electromagnetic propulsion systems are the way to go to other star systems, and that you would do it with a constant acceleration. You would get up to near the speed of light, cruise, and then brake, decelerate from near the speed of light down to normal velocities as you come into the planetary system, etc. And now, by the way, I have discovered something else that's very, very interesting about interplanetary space travel. And it's regarding the spacecraft design. And it mainly has to do when you come in to the atmosphere of another planet. How do you do it in so that it is basically feasible? The tack that NASA has used is to put a heat shield on the spacecraft. And typically the NASA spacecraft that are used for re-entry, and also the Russians, they're fairly dense. They're fairly massive. So that's one issue, is that they're very massive for their size. So when they come in, they to dump all of that energy, which is the 1/2 mv² energy, the kinetic energy, you have to get rid of that. The only way that's been devised so far is with a heat shield. So you have put a very thick layer. That's where Teflon came from, is a very low friction between the spacecraft and air. And as it heats up, it slowly burns off. And by the time it gets down into the dense part of the atmosphere, it's moving slower. You bring out some parachutes. It drops into the ocean. And you have come back to Earth. Or with the space shuttle, you put on tiles, ceramic tiles that dissipate the heat very rapidly, and so you come back into the atmosphere, and basically you turn the kinetic energy into heat. There's another way to do this. There's another way to change that kinetic energy and to manage that situation, and that's something that I've been working on in the background also. And I guarantee you, the aliens are not going to come in an Apollo-looking space capsule with a heat shield. They have another, more subtle method of getting into the atmosphere without creating a lot of heat. So, at any rate, that's something that's going on in the background. I hope that sometime within my lifetime, we see interstellar travel. I hope that sometime also that we see very rapid interplanetary travel. The unfortunate thing with the NASA programs, they are talking about, it's going to be, another 10 or 15 years before we can think about sending a man to Mars, and then we're going to send one man and expect that the cameras are going to send back his image, just like Matt Damon. And when you come to think of it, there's no real reason for sending anybody there because they can do all the filming in a Hollywood studio. I doubt if they sent Matt Damon to Mars to film the movie, They did it in a studio. Looked pretty real to me. Anyway, the point is that making interplanetary travel something that's expedient, very quick, we can have the average person sending payloads, for example, to Mars to land, do testing, understand weather, and then do some real science. We can also send the spacecraft out to comets, where instead of taking years to get there, it's going to take a very short amount of time. So at any rate, this is very important to understand the dynamics of space travel and how it's been really hidden from you by these bogus programs that's been fostered by NASA. So at any rate, and sorry about pounding on that drum, but it's very important. Sometimes you have to repeat things over and over again for people to assimilate the knowledge that, you know, that first of all, they have been handed a bill of goods that doesn't make any sense, but here's the right answer. Here's the answer that the real answer, here's the real way to do things, and it's not what you've always thought. It's very different. Getting to other planets, getting to other star systems, not a big deal. Okay, so at any rate, let me go back. I'm going to go back and do a little cover work on the release from last week. And these are just some fine points that, for example, on the very cover, the very first picture on the front of the release, there's the picture of the very famous monkey. And he's probably one of the more famous characters out of all of these fractal antennas on the Nazca planes. But I want you to look in the picture on his left arm. There is a fractal antenna. It's the broken fractal antenna. It starts down at the lower left hand of the picture. And that zigzags up, and it comes up to a point up at the upper right. And then that line drops down and crosses the monkey's arm. I want you to take a look at where that line crosses the monkey's arm. It stops. It breaks. And that is an electrical circuit consideration. If this were some artist out there walking around the Nazca plains drawing a pretty picture in the sand, there would be no reason to stop there. You would continue through. But if you did that, it would short-circuit the entire monkey electrically. And so it would act like a short circuit and cancel out the antenna effects of the monkey. So the people who designed this were well aware of the fact that they had to stop that straight line and not break through, cut through the monkey's arm. When you get to the other monkey's arm, it does the same thing. And then there's other examples of this type of circuit design consideration, antenna design consideration. Now, look at the monkey's back in this picture. It kind of has a little bit of waviness to it. And so that's because it's built on the Nazca planes, like I said last week, are undulating. They are not perfectly plain. They're not perfectly flat. But they're kind of rolling just ever so slightly. Well, if you look at the monkey's back, it's kind of curved. From this vantage point, this picture is taken from somewhat of an angle. And so if you look from vertical, right above the monkey, perfectly above the monkey, those curvatures in the monkey's back do not appear. This is why you have to understand these figurines, etc., were made from some entity that was up above. Far up above, and then if you look at them above, you don't find those irregularities in the shape of the monkey or the other parts of the fractal antennas, etc. And this is true in a lot of the other designs also. You can see the same effect very well by looking at the photos in the white paper where I'm on a mount. Now, this mount is at the southwest corner of the complex, and for those particular photos. And you can see that over the land is slightly, not hilly, you wouldn't say undulating is the only word I can think of. And if you're standing at an angle off to the side of these lines, if you're right behind the line, they're perfectly straight. I mean, that's about as straight a line as you can. That's like looking down the edge of a steel ruler. That's how straight they are. But if you're off to the side and you're looking at that line, it undulating over the hills, over the landscape, it's not straight. So to make these figures, you had to have been up above. That's the only way to really deal with this. So these were designs that were created by somebody. One thing I wanted to say, too, that these designs have a specific ring to them, so to speak. When you drive an electric current out into these antenna systems, each one of these figurines is going to have a special overtone characteristic to it, just like telling the difference between a piano and a flute. Now, this I talk about in the white paper, that these antennas have very specific design characteristics, and if you listen to them, you can, at a distance, say you were on another star system listening to these signals come in, you would be able to tell the characteristic signals coming from this entourage of figurines out in the Nazca Plains. You would be able to tell specifically that that's where these signals were coming from, and this is specifically this antenna group. Another thing is that the antennas can be disconnected or connected individually. So it's kind of like playing a piano where you have chords and different notes that you're playing. If you were playing the heron, the monkey, and the whale, it would be a different sound than if you were playing some other combination. Could this be part of the actual rhythm and codization of the information? I mean, this is so complicated. We really don't know. We don't know. I mean, I'm a specialist in the field of telecommunications and communications protocols. And believe me, if you don't have a set code for the receiving end and the transmitting end, then you're not going to understand each other. You are not going to be able to communicate. Eventually, you might be able to transmit back and forth and finally work out a code that was acceptable to both parties. But obviously, when things are built, for example, when you have it's a little radio set, one of those little over and out radio sets that you can use out in the woods or if you're on a hiking, sometimes people take these little walkie-talkies and they'll cover a couple mile span or a mile distance if the people are apart and you can talk and you talk, then I talk, little walkie-talkie type of things. But if you don't have a set protocol as to when somebody's going to call or how to contact somebody or what signal you first send to let them know, okay, here I'm transmitting now. In terms of telecommunications, you call that a frame. It's a package of information. It has a very set protocol, a very set number of bits, and those bits all mean something, and then the message is packed in the middle. You have error correction. You have all of these things, but the protocol is what the term is that we use in the industry. The protocol is very set. It's set in stone. Otherwise, like in the book, I use the example, it would be like two blind men speaking sign language. You're not going to communicate. At any rate, this is some more of the aspects of this very incredible discovery. At the very end of the paper, in the appendices, there's quite a bit of good information, and I got some very good commentary back from listeners who read the paper. They got all the way to the end, and then they went and spent the time going to the links that I have referenced in the appendices at the very end. Very, very good information there. But also in the appendice, I have an article. It's called Fractal Antennas, Design Characteristics and Application. And it's about an 8-page paper on, basically, it's a fundamental design paper for fractal antennas. And it gets you into kind of the subtle world. It's something I tried to describe in words last week on my release show. but it shows you how to take a dipole antenna and bend it and twist it into a fractal antenna and what the characteristics of fractal antennas are. They talk about the radio signaling, the gain and the absorption signaling characteristics of fractal antennas, etc. But the basic idea of a fractal antenna is you take and you combine lines into a small area, you weave them back and forth in a certain pattern, it gives you a very characteristic antenna reception. They are characteristic with frequency. Their signaling pattern also is characteristic with frequency. So this is very, very complicated electrodynamics, electromagnetism, and there's probably no area of electromagnetic theory that's more complicated than antenna design, and it's something that I had was fortunate enough to have worked into my engineering career, 25 years of my life spent in the telecommunications industry, all of that time maintaining my space science work, etc. But being adjacent to antenna design, printed circuit board design, all of the other types of design work that go into modern electronics, I was a principal systems engineer for the company that built the IBM compatible front end processors. And so we did everything. We did the hardware, we did the software. What an education. But that's the kind of education you could not possibly get in any university on the planet. Also in the appendix is a link to a webpage. It's a very good one. It's called Antenna Theory. And there's a sub page that goes along with that dealing with fractal antennas. And I've got the link to that at the end of the white paper also. The reason I included that is because antenna design is extremely complicated, but this is a wonderful page that takes you through the various types of antenna designs so you can see the complexity of antenna designs. I mean, this is just, and most of this, by the way, was figured out by hook or by crook, they say. That's a term in which you figure things out simply by doing them. In World War II, antenna design made great advancements because it was necessary for the war effort. And so a lot of great antenna design advancements taking place during World War II. But after World War II, that's where, for example, quasars were first noticed in World War II. They built some antennas. They pointed them towards the sky. They were looking for signals that were earthbound signals from other transmission points. And they, at the exact same time of day, they would pick up this radio blip. And they were like, what's going on here? And then they realized that it was related to sidereal time. I have a chapter on sidereal time in the white paper. Basically, sidereal time is star time. It's the time based on the stars. We base our day on time relative to noon and the solar position relative to Earth's spinning on its axis and going around in an orbit. But solar time is different. Solar time depends on the rotation of the Earth relative to the stars. And this is actually much better for astronomers. Astronomers use sidereal time all the time rather than solar time because they're looking typically at the stars, or if they're looking at planets or comets, etc., it is relative to the background of the stars, which is constant except for some nutations and some, for example, the precession, the approximate 26,000-year precession of Earth on its axis. But the sidereal time is something that is much more usable. And so, at any rate, it's important to understand sidereal time relative to the Nazca-Palpa complex because they would have been using sidereal time too, which is quite amazing when you understand that all of the pieces of knowledge that they had to understand to build this radio antenna complex that was uniquely designed to contact other star systems, to communicate with who knows who in other star systems. Quite absolutely amazing. Last week I ran out of time as I was reading off some of the chapters in the book. Let me read a couple other of the chapters. I call it a book, but it's a white paper, 74 pages. Here's another title of a chapter, Completing the Nazca Antenna Complex and Signaling Alien Star Systems, the Technologies Necessary for Completing the Complex. This is a really complex topic, but part of it is, should we be signaling at all to entities that we don't know about? And the answer is absolutely not. It's not a real good idea. You have to ask the question, if the Aztecs or the Incas or the Mayas knew what was in store for them, or even if they didn't, if they had the technology to, say, send radio signals over to Europe, and the people in Europe had the ability to receive them and interpret them, would the Aztecs or the Incas or the Mayas send a message to Europe and say, hey, Spanish, look at us. Here we are. Come and get us. I don't think so. Not a real good idea. So that brings into question, too, this idea of SETI, the search for intelligent life in the universe, and the fact that some of these people want to send signals out. And it's really not a good idea. And for that reason, I added a factor. I actually talked about this on my radio show a few weeks ago. I talked about the McCanny factor relative to what is known as the Drake equation. A guy named Frank Drake, very famous astronomer, devised an equation with all the various factors that would allow us to calculate the probability that there were other life forms in other star systems in the galaxy. It's known as the Drake equation. And after you multiply all of these probabilistic factors together, you get a probability of life in the universe, and then you multiply it by the total number of stars, and actually you can make an estimate of the number of intelligent life-bearing planets in the galaxy. And that's the whole end point, is just to see what's the probability, and people played with these factors ad nauseum, trying to figure out if there was life in the solar system or in the galaxy or not. But I have added another factor called the McCanny factor. That factor is zero. When you multiply all the other Drake equation factors together, you get an actual finite number. When you add in or not add in, when you multiply all of these by the McCanny factor, you get zero. The McCanny factor says that if you are an intelligent species and you realize that there are potential for aliens out there, some of them good, maybe some of them not so swell, and also looking at the history, just in our own world history, that every time a nation gets up and running and starts to do halfway decent, it seems that some imperial nation from outside comes in and tries to take it over and steal everything that it's done, that they've accomplished. And so, at any rate, that's our situation here. If they don't already know about us, do we want to start signaling some alien entity going, hey out there, here we are, come and take us to the cleaners? You know, I don't think that's a very good idea. So my addition to the Drake equation is the McCanny factor equal to zero. And that's literally why. So that we cannot be sending out signals to other star systems. But the interesting thing about the Nazca Palpa lines is, if these were left by aliens or other human type of races that are occupying the galaxy, if these in fact are were made and left for us to communicate, then we have to look at it this way, that if they were going to come and trounce on us, they would have already done it. They had the capability, they were here, they would have trounced on us a long time ago. They didn't have to wait for us to discover the Nazca lines, etc. So the point is that with the signaling from the Nazca lines, you could feel relatively safe about signaling out to other star system, because if, like I say, if they realize these signals, if they pick them up, they know they're coming from us, from the race that developed on planet Earth or whatever they call it, they would not pose a threat, because if they wanted to, they would have already done us in. They had all the capability, etc. One other thing I wanted to accomplish is to do topographic mapping of the area. In this, there is some data available, but I don't trust it. I don't think it's very good. And there's going to be a while till we can verify the data that's available for topographic mapping. But once that's accomplished, then we can make scale models of the Nazca antenna complex and the Palpa complex. By doing this, we'll have the ability to rebuild these on a small scale and then test the antenna patterns, because that won't change. The frequency will change, other things will change, but the overtones and the relative overtones of the various circuits and antennas will not change. They will be relative to the scale models. Just like if you're building a scale model of a mountain on a desktop, you can make it one time or two times or three times what they call exaggeration, or you can make it one time and it would look exactly like real, down to the scale of the mountains or whatever you were building. So and this could all be done with 3D printing. There's a lot of modern technology that can be brought to the table. So at any rate, a lot of studying still has to be done here, and then come appendices and references, etc. Also in the appendices, I have some examples of simple dipole antennas and the gain and the antenna patterns and things like that, so you can get an idea of the complexity of antennas. And then at the very end, I have a series of pictures that I took at the Maria Reich Museum just north of the Nazca plains. I wanted to add a comment here that the Nazca plains are very unusual in that they're right off of the mountains of the Andes Mountains, and it looks like I can't really say this for sure, but it looks like there could have been some work to create these plains or modify them to be very flat. Anyway, remember, go to my webpage, jmccsci.com, best water filters on the planet or in this side of the universe. The new releases there, all of my books, CDs, DVDs, etc. The website, jmccsci.com. S is in Sam, C is in Charlie, I is in Indigo.com, 7 letters. And once again, we'll see you next week. This is Jim McCanny. This is my Science Hour. And as always, we are at the crossroads. Good night.